How do you get from what was to what is? Success does not mean there are elections within 24 months. Success means that Iran's capacity to do harm is limited, and there's a transition, a clear, workable transition path to an orderly progress towards something better. When you have decades of rule by terror, you build up a big supply of vendettas.
G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. When the bombs started raining down on Iran, I could think of one person who I really wanted to help me understand what was going on, what might happen, what the consequences might be in the Middle East and also around the world and for American democracy itself. That person was David Frum, who had a front row seat to the last time America went to war in the Middle East, and it didn't go so well. Frum was George W. Bush's speechwriter, well, one of four speechwriters, but he wrote a very famous line which came to define American foreign policy for the first decade of the 21st century. It was in George W. Bush's first State of the Union address. It was just 4 months after the World Trade Center towers had been turned to rubble, and President Bush said this.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
So this idea of President Bush's, of David Frum's, of the rest of the Bush administration, that America faced a sort of a rogue alliance of terrorist states, provided the rationale for going to war against one of them, Iraq. And the way that war went and the impact that it had on American politics informed a lot of Frum's later thinking. At the time, David Frum wrote a book with Richard Perle, who was another neoconservative hawk and an architect of the war in Iraq in 2004, which in fact argued, among other things, for taking immediate and decisive action against Iran as well. That book was called An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. But you fast forward 22 years and David Frum is older and wiser and more contemplative. He's also one of the most prominent and persuasive conservative voices against Donald Trump. He's written two books against Donald Trump. The first one is called Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. The other is called Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he hosts The David Frum Show, which is a podcast. And as I say, since the invasion of Iraq and his time in the Bush administration, he's developed a much more nuanced understanding of America's role in the world and the hazards of intervention in the Middle East. So I wanted to get him on the line and help me understand the precarious position in which the current conflict in Iran puts not just the Middle East and the region, but in fact, American democracy itself. I hope you enjoy as much as I did the one, the only, David Frum. I do want to talk to you about the domestic concerns that you have about what a Trump administration might be able to do with wartime powers to American democracy and freedom of the press, because I was kind of chilled to read your eloquent writing on that over the past few days. But let's start with the big global stuff. What's the best case you could make for striking Iran if it wasn't the Trump administration? Let's suppose that it's, you know, it's like Colin Powell and President John McCain in this scenario. What's the case for it?
The best case I've heard is summed up by a joke that is apparently circulating inside Iran. And some of your viewers, listeners may have heard the joke, so forgive me if you have. But if you haven't, here it is. A foreign agent approaches an Iranian and asks the Iranian, are you willing to work with the United States and Israel to overthrow the Khomeini theocratic regime? And the Iranian says, I am willing to do so. And the foreign agent says, you understand, this is very dangerous. You could be putting your life at risk. And the Iranian says, I do understand that. I am willing. And the foreign agent says, very good, $100,000. The Iranian suddenly looks troubled, grits his teeth, and he says, that's a fair price. He said, but I don't have that money all at once. May I pay in installments?
Right. So it's a humanitarian. That's a humanitarian case.
That's the case. The case is that there are many cases, but the case that I think that we all find the most moving is this great civilization, this ancient civilization, this country that has a tradition of constitutional democracy dating back to the early 20th century, has risen in its millions for freedom. and thousands, possibly tens of thousands of people died. And the president of the United States promised those people that help was coming. Now, I don't think much of this president, and maybe you don't think much of this president, but to the people of Iran, he's the president of the United States. He speaks for the great American nation, and he promised them that he would help. And it's hard to walk away from that promise, even when you know who made it. So that's the core of the case. There are other cases too, but that's the one I think is most immediately, urgently powerful.
Let's suppose, David, that he hadn't made the promise, and that we weren't just reacting because we'd backed ourselves into a corner and didn't want to, you know, lose face about having made a promise. We make lots of promises. There was Obama's red line about chemical weapons in Syria. Right. There was the promise in 91 to the Kurds to rise up against Saddam Hussein. There was the promise in the 50s that Hungarians should rise up. You know, history is littered with our broken promises.
I'm a big believer that the United States should keep its promises. And I think those instances you cite are shameful cases. And either the promise should not have been made, if there is no plan to keep it, as Hungary 56, or the promise should have been honored, as it was should have been in Iraq 1991. So we have that. There was a promise. But even in the absence of a promise, we have had a freedom movement in a country that is both one of the world's most repressive and one of the world's most aggressive. And while this current round of the high-intensity conflict between the Islamic Republic, that is the government, not the people of Iran, and the United States and its allies, this round has been initiated by the United States and by Israel. There are many rounds before that. This has been a long-running, never-ceasing conflict dating back to 1979. And there was an opportunity, I'm continuing the case, there was an opportunity to achieve a decisive outcome, to denuclearize the Islamic Republic, and maybe even to bring about a better regime that is clearly what the majority of the people there want, or the great majority. So that's the case. Then you bump into the fact that it's the Trump presidency.
Let's talk about how you assemble a coalition and a plan to do the thing that you want to do, if you actually are clear on what you want to do, which is to get rid of the regime altogether and replace it with something that is more humane and also more of a responsible international partner, rather than just what some people suspect Donald Trump really wants, which is just another person who could be equally bad for Iranians, but is more compliant with America's wishes. Back in the Iraq War in 2003, just can you remind us of what the Bush administration did as the decision was developing that this was going to be a thing that they needed to do in order to sort of tick the check boxes of what one does before such an adventure?
Well, this is kind of old-timey, but President Bush, George W. Bush, assembled a coalition, an international coalition of, I'm going to forget now, but dozens of nations. If I remember this right, there are actually more participant nations in the 2003 Iraq War than there were in the 1991 Gulf War. I mean, some important nations were missing, like France, but the total number of participants was greater in 2003 than in 1991, if I remember correctly. Then he went, of course, to Congress for an authorizing resolution. Then he went to the United Nations and asked for a UN resolution, which he did not get. But he tried. He tried twice, actually, to get a UN resolution. But he had a global coalition. He had a congressional resolution. And he had one more thing, which is that when the 1991 war ended, that is the war fought by H.W. Bush to liberate Kuwait from Saddam Hussein, when that war ended, Iraq was bound by a series of UN resolutions about governing its future behavior, which Iraq had. Did I say Iran? Iraq was...
No, you said Iraq. Yep.
Okay. Was wrapped in a series of UN resolutions governing its future behavior, which they broke through the 1990s. And those resolutions were enforced. There was a near war in 1994. There was, in 1998, very powerful airstrike by the Clinton administration, again, because Iraq was in breach of the post-1991 UN resolutions. And those resolutions had been breached again.
And these so, although were, the UN what, did, just remind us, David, what were these resolutions surrounding? What were the breaches in the 90s that Iraq was doing?
These were about cooperation with international arms inspections, both having to do with nuclear weapons, biological and chemical. And they also had to do with human rights for the Kurds in northern Iraq. That's what nearly caused a war in 1994. So although Bush failed to get a new authorizing resolution from the UN in 2003, he could point to a network of previous resolutions and argue, not farcically, that Iraq was in breach and he was going to now try to enforce those resolutions.
And were you privy to different factional sort of opinions that were operating in the Bush administration at the time as to whether or not it was worth bothering to go to the United Nations, certainly going back a second time, versus people in the administration who thought this is all just fig leaf legalistic nonsense. We know what we're going to do anyway, so let's just do it.
Yeah. Well, I had a view of these conversations, not at the most senior level. I was not only a speechwriter, but I had a speech. My portfolio was domestic policy. I wrote speeches on trade, on taxes, on education, on farm, on highway. I mean, I had the entire. There are four writers, three of whom did international, and I did everything else. So I was, when there was a shortage of labor, I was called in on the international portfolio. But my main job, day in and day out, was to write speeches about the farm bill. It seemed important at the time, but many of my best efforts are lost to the mists of history. They were good, I want to say, but they are lost to the mists of history. But I did have a good. I mean, I was a special assistant, which is the rank below assistant, though that's where the White House power structure really begins. But I was aware of these debates, There was great debate about whether the president needed to go back to the United Nations, whether he should go to the United Nations at all. But there was no debate about whether he needed to go to Congress. Everyone understood, look, you have to go to Congress. Sooner or later, Congress is going to vote the money for your war or not. Mm. And if you don't ask them in advance, it's a lot harder to get the money for it for the war later. So it's just as a matter even of good housekeeping, never mind constitutional and legal principle, of course you have to go to Congress to say, do I have your permission to do this? It's not quite modern presidents have avoided formal declarations of war. According to the U.S. Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war. But that's gone out of style since 1945 for the following reason. Once a president declares war, he gains all kinds of vast powers over law, over the economy, over other things. And post-1945 Congresses have said, look, we can authorize military force without giving the president the full panoply of powers that would come from a declaration of war. So there's no declaration of war in Korea. There was no declaration of war in Vietnam. There's no declaration of war in Gulf War I. But there are various kinds of authorizing resolutions to approve the conflict, to give the president permission to carry it, and to promise him that he would have the funds he needed in order to carry on the conflict without saying, oh, by the way, you also have the power to freeze bank accounts.
David, this is always something that's a little bit weird to non-Americans like myself, and I wonder what you make of it as a Canadian. The ability of a country to essentially go to war without saying that it's going to war. Has this ever been tested in court? I mean, I'd be interested to know what the Supreme Court has to say about an administration carrying on a major combat operation over a significant duration without getting the approval of Congress and just saying, well, we don't have to because it's not a war. Like, if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck.
So I'm not going to pretend to have any kind of expertise, and I can't cite cases, but I know it was tested. It was tested a lot during the Vietnam era. Vietnam had more legal authority. Korea, there was no vote by Congress because President Truman said in Korea, this is at a time of the war, of course, begins in June of 1950. It's a time of great hope in the United Nations. And the United States has signed a treaty with the United Nations that says we will defend countries that are victims of aggression. And according to the United States Constitution, treaties are part of the supreme law of the land. So President Truman's argument in 1950 was we have a commitment to our UN partners. North Korea has violated the UN charter. I am, as a matter of principle, not going to ask for a declaration of war. Also, I don't want to be able to freeze bank accounts and have all those powers over the economy that Franklin Roosevelt had during World War II. But I am going to war. I'm going to fight to enforce the UN charter. And that was something I'm sure it was tested at the time. I know that in Vietnam, where there was an authorizing resolution, the famous Tonkin Gulf resolution, that was challenged in court. And again, the courts have said that's good enough. And there's also the practical question that Congress has to vote appropriations all the time to fund the war. So if Congress disapproves of war, this is how Congress in the end forced an end to the Vietnam War. Something, by the way, one of my first political memories, I was very upset and scandalized that Congress did this, but they simply said no more money. They after the end of U.S. combat operations in Vietnam in 73. Congress cut off assistance to the South Vietnamese, and that was that. They didn't pay for it, no fighting.
I mean, all of this, of course, assumes that of the three branches of government, the legislative branch is actually functioning as an independent branch and not as a lackey of the executive branch as we have at the moment. So I suppose it's kind of moot as to whether or not, you know, he goes for congressional
approval.
It's
not moot. Trump has a huge, huge problem with the congressional funding. So I saw a report today that the war is costing $1 billion a day, which I have no idea whether that's right, but it doesn't sound like a crazy, impossible number when you see the ordnance that is being deployed. Now, there is money in channels, but at some point, at that rate, at some point, President Trump will have to go to Congress and say, I need another appropriation. I don't think there is a funding majority in this Congress. He's got the Republican majority in the House of Representatives is hanging by like one or two members. There are at least half a dozen Republicans who do not want to fund an Iran war. So he will need to find Democrats to go along with him on funding this war. And the Democrats are saying, even those who are broadly sympathetic to a tough approach to Iran, say, you didn't ask us first. This is going to be, in a week or two or three or four, a big problem. Mm. Congress will say, maybe we would have funded the war if you'd asked us. You didn't ask us.
Right.
And now you're asking for funding, and we're not going to do it.
I mean, that's interesting. I hadn't really made that delineation. And when I said it's sort of moot, I didn't mean that it's not going to cause problems down the track, but rather that the congressional approval for the war in the first place was probably moot because it's inconceivable that Congress wouldn't have voted for what Donald Trump wants to do initially, even if they then had problems with financing it down the track, isn't it?
He does not have a functional majority in the House of Representatives anymore. And this is the reason why the February, we're going down many different paths, and I hope I'm not being too scattered in my
approach. No, please.
But one of the reasons that the February 20th decision at the Supreme Court about the tariffs case was so important was Donald Trump, in his tariffs claim, was trying to create sources of revenue for the executive completely independent of Congress. And he said, I can declare an economic emergency. I can impose a tariff of any amount on any country at any time for any duration, and no one can say anything. And for the first time since the Stuart monarchs of the 1600s, you'll have an English-speaking head of government who has a source of revenue that doesn't depend on the legislature. Remember, the last English-speaking head of government to try it was Charles I, and the English cut off his head for it. And the Supreme Court didn't cut off Donald Trump's head, but they cut off his money and said, no, you can't do that. The money comes from Congress.
It's interesting. David French had a good piece, David, about the wisdom that the founding fathers of the United States had in taking all of the roles of a monarch and scattering them through three branches of government and scattering them in such a way that, you know, each one would need the cooperation of another branch, so that there were all these checks and balances. And it's normal for courts to defer to presidents, and even more normal to defer to presidents maximally during wartime. And the worry about a president who has not been particularly pedantic about respecting the rights and liberties of the American people and the freedom of the press is that during war, it's going to be even more easy for him to say, well, I have to make sure that we impose these restrictions on people and that we prevent journalists from asking questions of the Pentagon and prevent, I don't know, people from getting within a certain number of feet of a polling station or whatever it might be. Because this is not just an imaginary emergency like the previous emergencies have been. This is an actual war. I mean, the other thing that's interesting is the idea of whether or not you even the fig leaf of sort of international respect for, you know, American respect for international institutions before going to war is an interesting one. Is it better to be like a hypocrite and pretend that you care about going to war and with, you know, proper UN authorization, even though you know that you're going anyway and you're only using it as a fig leaf? Or is it better to not be a hypocrite, but to steamroll, you know, international institutions?
International laws, people talk about it as if it's a much clearer thing than it really is. So there are two main bodies of international law. There's what's called international private law. British jet smacks into a Japanese plane on an Australian tarmac, injuring American and South Korean passengers. Who pays the liability? How does the liability get apportioned? And there are lots and lots of a vast body of law that governs that accident. And if any of the countries don't like the result, then they can go back to the International Airline Convention or whatever it is and renegotiate the rules. There's a sovereign backup. So international private laws is a pretty robust system, at least among the developed countries. Then there's this thing called international public law, which purports to govern the actions of governments. And the question about that always is, well, where does this law come from and how is it enforced? And there are a lot of people in the international legal community who dream of a day when academics and international tribunals will confect an international public law that binds governments over their own objection. But there's some real problems with this, including that if what ends up happening is that this system of law is created by a majority of the world's governments, but a majority of the world's governments are repressive. Democracies are a minority.
And they also have particular grudges against particular countries, like, you know, big countries like Israel, big countries like America, Jewy countries like Israel, you know, whatever it might be.
And a lot of it just seems to be sort of, and when you press hard, I mean, so you get these things, you'll have on the internet, these statements, international lawyers say, and what they really mean is me and my fellow academics think that's the way it should be. And we are ignoring the fundamental principle of international law, which is governments are bound only by their own consent. And after that, you're into the realm of politics.
Just to pause there, just so we don't oversimplify it, David. I mean, the members of the United Nations Security Council have agreed to be bound by the condition of the Security Council, which is that you don't go to war unless without Security Council authorization. Yeah. I think that's the salient bit of international law that people care about when they talk about whether or not the Iraq war was legal or illegal internationally. There wasn't Security Council approval. America had agreed that you need Security Council approval to go to war. It didn't get it. It went to war anyway, broke the rules.
Yes, but you always have a right of self-defense, and you also have treaty laws. So, for example, in 1994, in the early 1990s, I should say, Ukraine gave up its nuclear arms. It inherited a big arms arsenal from the Soviet Union. It surrendered that in return for a four-way treaty with Russia, guaranteed by Russia, the United States, and Great Britain, that Ukraine's borders would be inviolate and its sovereignty would be upheld if it surrendered the nuclear weapons. When Ukraine is attacked, it doesn't need a new Security Council resolution to have the right to get the aid it's promised by treaty in 1994 when it's attacked in 2014. And so it's a complicated thing. But the idea that countries' rights depend ultimately on these structures of international law, you know, there's a project to make it seem like the country's own democratic rules don't matter very much compared to what international lawyers say. And that, as you say, it's complicated. And we are trying to move toward a rule in which countries are governed more by agreement. But the attempt to make things say, if there's not a UN vote, it's not legal. That's just not the way it's understood to be.
Is it worth paying lip service to? I mean, obviously, the administration that you were part of thought that it was important to at least try to go to the UN and then try to go back to the UN again after they didn't get authorization from the Security Council the first time. Here you have a situation in which I suppose the person who most embodies this kind of worldview for me is maybe J.D. Vance, along with maybe Pete Hegseth, where it's like, you know, it's the might is right kind of, you know, was it Vance who was talking in these very kind of almost messianic, apocalyptic, like millenarian terms about like the fundamental iron law of the universe from the earliest days is that the powerful, you know, will prevail. It's this kind of attitude of like, yeah.
So we don't want that world, I don't think. And
why not though? Let's just pause on that because that seems to be part of, I think, the ethos of the new right, of the kind of play acting, like fun, Trumpy MAGA. Like we are the biggest swinging dick in town. Why not just use it? Like, why are we constraining ourselves with all of these rules that were made up by a bunch of people in, you know, The Hague and Brussels and all that nonsense? We can do it. Let's do it.
Here's a very practical reason why you don't do it. At any given moment in history, there's always one country that is stronger than the others. And in the West, that country was in the 1500s, it was Spain. In the 1600s, it was France. 1700s, it was France. Then it was Germany. But the problem is if you're the strongest country, you're stronger than any other country, but you're not stronger than every other country. And so the danger, if one country becomes very powerful and it becomes a threat, the other countries combine against it and tear it down. And that's the story of Napoleon. That's the story of Kaiser Wilhelm. That's the story of the Soviet Union. That's the story of the Nazis. The genius of American foreign policy is from the moment when the United States became the world's strongest country. What is that moment? 1918, 1940, whenever you date it to, 1945. From that moment, the United States has said, right, we are not going to let give the other countries of the world reason to combine against us. And not only that, we're going to offer them this deal. If you ally with us, you get access to our market, the world's biggest market, and you get protection, and you get a kind of discount. We ask you to pay something, but you get much more protection than you could ever possibly afford from us at a big discount. And all we ask in return is that you not combine against us. And so you've had, from 1945, the unusual event in world history, which has lasted from Roosevelt until Donald Trump, where the single strongest country in the world was also the center of the single most powerful alliance in the world. Throughout the diplomatic history of the world, everything called a grand alliance, Churchill wrote books about them, was always aimed against country. It was countries 2 through 10 against country 1. The United States has been able to get countries 1, then through 3 through 10 to combine against country number 2. And that's what Vance and the others are ignoring. They're saying, we're going to be like the France of Louis XIV or Philip II of Spain or Kaiser Wilhelm or the Soviet Union. We're just going to impose our will without regard to the others. There are a lot of others. And together, they are more powerful than you.
I mean, their argument, I suppose, is that, like, yeah, if the other countries were getting essentially a discount because they got our umbrella of security so that they could spend their money on their fancy universal healthcare or whatever without paying for their own defense, then America was being ripped off, and it's time to knock a few heads together, because what are they going to do? What's Canada and America and Ireland, you know, and Spain? Or they're all going to get together and they're going to invade the United States? Give me a break.
Yeah. No, so that's a fair point. I mean, let's remember that at the beginning of the system, it was not an oversight that Germany didn't have a powerful army anymore and Japan didn't have a powerful navy anymore. That was the plan. You guys work on what you produce advanced consumer goods and leave the provision of security to us. That was not a mistake. That was a plan. But at this point in history, it's a reasonable thing to say to the allies, you should contribute more to your own defense, especially the European allies who have been kind of free riders. But on the other hand, they do pay for other things. As in the early days of the Ukraine war, for example, Americans would complain the United States was giving much more to Ukraine's military budget than Europe. Well, that's true. But Ukraine also has to operate hospitals. It has to operate schools. It has to operate a pension program. And when you combine all those necessary forms of civilian spending, very difficult for a country at war, the Europeans were supporting that. And if you added up the European contributions to the Ukrainian civilian economy in 2023 to the U.S. contributions to the Ukrainian military economy, they're about equal. They were just making a false comparison of only looking at the military budget and saying, well, the United States gives so much, Europe gives so little, they're ripping us off.
And
someone had to pay for the hospitals.
Yeah. And since let's follow the thread of hospitals and schools and water and public pensions and transpose that onto Iran now, because, you know, one of the big concerns about the Iraq war back in the day, and I remember, I mean, I was still in college, but I was writing for the university newspaper and was on some radio show at the time and was talking and saying, look, if there was a Marshall Plan for Iraq, then I think I would probably lean towards supporting the war. This was before the war. But without any faith that this administration is going to follow through and do a proper rebuilding process, I think on balance, it's a bad idea. Well, I mean, if one had those concerns before the Iraq war, in which at which point there were many people in the administration who did really feel that you needed to proactively attempt to, reconstruct Iraq, or, you know, how much more dire are those concerns now, where you don't have any boots on the ground, you're just doing an air war, and you don't have any control over what happens to the power vacuum that you're creating?
And look, once the Mullah regime collapses, however robust the civilizational resources of Iran are, there's going to be a very uncomfortable period of transition. Iran has a series of horrific problems. Water's probably the most pressing and urgent. They have a tremendous crisis of water in all their cities. It's a very arid place to live. They're going to need electricity. It's a poor country, but it's kind of artificially poor. You know, one of my favorite charts about Iran is if you start the chart, look at income per capita and compare Iran to Portugal. From 1960 to 1980, they're the same. And then in the 70s, Portugal makes some very good choices. They become a democracy. They join the European Union. They adopt free trade. And Portugal's GDP per capita rises up and up and up. And now in the 2020s, they're fully developed. Not the richest one of them all, but they've got the tramways and the hospitals and good universities and good colleges and K-12 education and pensions and, you know, all the attributes of a fully paid up member of the first world. And Iran is poorer today per person than it was in 1980. They went nowhere. And so Iran has the potential to look a lot like a Southern European country, but to get from here to there is going to be difficult. They're going to need help. And yeah, you need once you start breaking their government, as terrible as it is, it does keep the water going. It does keep the electricity moving. And whoever comes next is going to inherit all of that responsibility in a much more fragmented and battered society.
Mm. So we started the conversation with, like, what is the best case rationale for going into Iran if it wasn't this administration that was doing it? Now let's talk about the sort of worst case consequences of doing that. Like, if you're going into a mission like this, what are the broad categories of outcomes that you want to be thinking about?
The things I'm most worried about are not going to happen in the Middle East. They're going to happen here at home. And here's the thing I'm worried about. So last weekend, we had another terrible mass shooting in the United States, this one in Austin, Texas. And there's now an apprehended alleged shooter. And the apprehended alleged shooter was photographed at the time of the shooting wearing a t-shirt with an Iranian flag on it. Now, I don't believe for a minute that he's in any way connected to the Iranian state or is an agent of the Iranian government. But if this war begins to drag, if it becomes difficult, if Congress won't give money to Donald Trump, how hard will it be for Donald Trump to say, you know, we have a risk of Iranian terrorism? That's not crazy. We do. The world has been dealing with Iranian terrorism since 1979. And these traitors in Congress won't defend the homeland. And we need vigorous, decisive action here at home. We need a crackdown. We need and if newspapers report things they shouldn't report, they're supporting the Iranian terrorists. We need to fund the Department of Homeland Security and give them much broader powers, even than the ones they already have. We need a lot more secrecy. And don't ask me about my deals with the United Arab Emirates. That's crucial to national security and are protecting us. That you have a permission structure, to abuse power by people who've proven they want to do it. And the most alarming thing is, you know, Ukraine's not carrying out elections because of the disruption of war. And I think that's a decision that is justified by the facts. But there are people around Donald Trump who are circulating plans. The New York Times and Washington Post have reported on this. These are just in voices, but offering Trump roadmaps to cancel the 2026 elections in the United States and use the military to do it. That's the kind of thing I worry about. Not so much military disaster in Iran, although that's a worry too, but that Trump will use this war to crack down on liberties at home. And that's not a fanciful possibility, the way people used to say, oh, Obama's going to send the National Guard to Texas to take away everyone's guns. He wasn't going to do that. In this case, we're talking about things that Trump has said he wants to do, that people around Trump have said they want to do, things that have already been tried.
Mm. And we're talking about a president who has tried to push the edge of the envelope to the greatest extent possible, and then just sort of dare the courts to prevent him on so many different levels, you know, in terms of, you know, prosecuting journalists or whatever it might be. You know, there is almost no field in which he hasn't tried to test the edges of things. So if war then extends those edges to a much broader parameter of powers, then that is a worry. In terms of the election, is it in the Constitution that the United States has to have an election within a certain period of time, like in parliamentary democracies where the government is obligated to hold it before a certain date?
We have an even more robust defense than that. It's in the state constitutions.
Ah.
The president, this is the thing that has been frustrating to Donald Trump. If Donald Trump, he's looking around the laboratory for the big Dr. Frankenstein switch, which he can flip. To say no election, and he discovers that switch is in Sacramento. The whole architecture of American elections rests on state law, state practice, This creates a lot of chaos. This is one of the reasons why election lawyers make such a fabulous living, because it's a tissue of complicated law, but it also defeats aggressors. One of the things that happened in 2016 when the Russians were fooling around with American elections is they tried to tamper with the American voting process, and they were defeated because it's a chaos. Because while the law is the states, the administration is often county by county. So where do I hack the election machines? Well, there are 3,000 counties.
Good luck. Go for it. Yeah.
I think there's something like 9,000 separate voting jurisdictions in the United States, and they all have their own technology. Good luck.
Right. So then suppose that the election itself needs to take place because these are being organized locally and at a state level on the, you know, much as Trump might want to, people are going to be going to the polls. What is your, just put some flesh on the bones of your nightmare scenario about a wartime president using wartime powers?
Most of our elections are not very close. So you don't have to seize, to interfere with an election in the United States, you don't have to fool around in California. You don't have to fool around in New York or Texas or Nebraska. The number of states where election outcomes are really decided is a small number. So if you can create a crisis in certain districts in North Carolina, certain districts in Georgia, certain districts in Arizona, that may be enough. Now, the problem Trump has in 2026 is he is now so unpopular that it may be that the playing field is much bigger than it was in past elections. But again, you don't have to steal every election to swing the balance in the House of Representatives. You just have to steal the handful that are close. And again, 2026, there may be more elections that are up for grabs than there have been in the past. But normally of the 435 seats in the House, the election typically turns on 20, 30, maybe 40.
It's amazing, isn't it? You're talking about like 5% of the seats or something that are determining the entire governance of the nation and the accountability structure of a president who might be breaking the law. And just lastly on domestic stuff, because I do want to get back to Iran and to various outcomes, the isolationism of Donald Trump in 2016 versus I always sort of felt when he came back into power a second time that at some point he's going to open the train box and he's going to assemble the train and he's going to go, look at how great this train is. What am I doing not using it? And he's going to think I'm an idiot for not using this military that I've got. And I think in the first term, he just wasn't that interested in it. He didn't really think about it. And then, of course, I mean, you have the power unilaterally to just snap your fingers and all of a sudden, hundreds of people who are far more accomplished than you are flying through the night towards Nicolas Maduro's compound and blasting Cubans out of the, you know, into pink mist. And you just have to say it. Of course, someone with the narcissism of Trump is going to find that compelling. But can you make a kind of intellectual journey from his America First isolationism to whatever he's doing in Iran?
Well, somebody asked me a little while ago, what about those people who voted for Trump who believed him about staying out of foreign wars? What about them? And my response was a little cynical was, if you believe Donald Trump, that's a you problem. That's not a him problem.
Yeah, right.
So as you said, the story about how Donald Trump discovered the term America First was he was giving an interview in the summer of 2016 to David Sanger of the New York Times and other journalists, and he began saying things that sounded isolationist. And Sanger, who's one of the most distinguished and learned national security journalist in Washington, said, it sounds like you're talking about America First. And according to Sanger, Trump sort of blinked and stared. What did you just say? He said, like, America First. Trump, that's fantastic.
As if Sanger had just coined it.
I'm using that. And indeed, there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence of him using it in his own voice. It shows up in some of his ghostwritten books. But if that's true, but he wasn't an isolationist. He always wanted to use power in certain ways. What he did was he had countries he liked and countries he didn't like. And the countries he liked were authoritarian regimes with a lax attitude toward law. And the countries he didn't like were rule of law countries, especially in Europe, but just generally Canada and Australia, he didn't love either. And he wanted not to be entangled in certain disputes, but was very ready to be entangled in other disputes. And of course, even in the first term, that he got into conflicts and confrontations with China that were putting us on the way to great power conflict pre-COVID of a kind that people have been worried about for a long time. And he didn't seem to have a natural system to stop it before it got out of control.
Right. But I mean, specifically his antipathy towards Middle Eastern adventures going into these, you know, so-called shithole countries that are way too complicated and we don't know what's going on and getting ourselves messed up and spending American blood and treasure like that. He would be banged on about that a lot in the primaries in the Republican Party when he was up against Jeb Bush and all that.
He inherited a war in northern Iraq and Syria against ISIS from Barack Obama, and Trump continued it, made it bigger. He did not stop the war in Afghanistan. That continued through the entire Trump presidency. He killed Qasem Soleimani, the head of the, I forget now which, but one of the most elite units.
It was the Quds, I think, wasn't it?
That's right. Thank you. And again, I think that's probably a good call and maybe something that only Donald Trump would do, but that's not isolationist, that he was willing to intervene. He had an instinct for avoiding things that were going to bog him down and for avoiding difficulty and going for the fast, quick, easy win. Partly because he did not want to go ask Congress for money. So he looked for ways to either continue things that already were on the books, like the ISIS war and the Afghanistan war in the first term, or to do something spectacular and cheap, like killing Soleimani.
So you take out Khamenei and you take out the, you know, whatever is left of the nuclear program that you didn't get last summer, and you decapitate the senior leadership. If you're doing a Venezuela model, then you just look for somebody who, you know, you don't care about the fact that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is still going to be terrorizing civilians. You just find someone who you can work with, and you say, see, now I'm fucking serious. You thought that I wasn't serious. Now let's sit down and talk and see whether you're going to play games the way you have been for the past, you know, years or decades. That's obviously not what he's done because, you know, apparently they were just meeting to try to find a new leader and they bombed that meeting as well. So you've lost these scores and scores of people at the top of the government. Then option two seems to be the whole thing, what, collapses, but everybody rises up and somehow forms a new, like, what is the opposition alternative that does not just default to the Revolutionary Guard Corps finding the most vicious individual, vicious and charismatic and power-hungry and ruthless individual who ends up replacing Khamenei and is maybe even crazier or even more jihadist or even more committed to secretly sponsoring Western megaterrorism than Khamenei was? Like, lay the landscape of what the options are now.
I think I know what the Trump people are hoping for. What they're hoping is that Khamenei was a fanatic and there are fanatics around him. But if you kill the top 200 people in the regime, that's where your shovel begins to hit the crooks. And there are a lot of people down at guy number 201, 202, 203, who are basically crooks and who, with a little pastiche of Islamism, a little pastiche of piety, but crooks. And those are the kind of people that maybe you can do business with. And I think what the Trump people hope is we start saying to guy number 201, how would you like to be the supreme leader and live and keep your money? And guy number 201 doesn't like it. So you kill him and you go to guy number 202 and eventually find somebody who says yes. And at that point you've got a governmental structure that is more or less continuous with what you have now and what the better people in Trump, what Marco Rubio, who's probably the best of them, hopes would happen, I think, is we get to guy number 202. He becomes the new supreme leader. He rules through a mixture of more corruption and less terror. And then he begins the transition. But he also understands that if he wants to be a more successful crook, he needs to run a richer country. And that means Iran needs to reintegrate with the rest of the world, abandon the terrorism. And you get a kind of gradual transition to a more benign form of government. The model here is Greece, Spain, Portugal in the 1970s, where you go from dictatorship to democracy over a decade.
So you said, like, what if man 202 is committed to more corruption but less terror? Well, let's suppose that man 203 is committed to more corruption and more terror also, but he's not going to tell you that. How can you tell the difference between 202 and 203? And what if you accidentally go to 203 first, but he looks like 202?
There's no question there's a lot of wishful thinking in this plan. But I think that the premise of the plan is that the regime is pretty rotten at this point, and the number of true believers is actually by now quite small, and it's mostly crooks. So if you pick a guy from 201 to 210, even at random, the odds are very high he's fundamentally a crook.
And by crook, just to clarify, you mean somebody who is more interested in lining their own pockets than in doing some grand ideological move against the Zionists or the right. Great Satan or something, like basically not a non-ideological hack.
I read, I don't know this, but I read that the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, control about 30 to 40% of the economy. They control the construction. They control everything of any scale. And they control that both collectively, but many people have individual companies, and they will want to keep those companies, Marco Rubio hopes. And so that they may be willing to do business. If the United States says to them, look, that large construction company you have, you keep it. We're not asking too many questions. And the money you have in the bank account in Dubai or Qatar, we're not asking questions about it. All we ask is that you govern in a more modern and humane way, and you reorient yourself more to the West, and you give up the terrorism, which is anyway very expensive. I mean, why isn't Iran as wealthy as Portugal? They've poured trillions of dollars into empire and aggression. And if you just stop doing that, there are a lot of resources, both for the needs of people, but also to enrich the leaders.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a corrupt and closed economy, which doesn't help productivity growth versus being a liberal free market democracy. But so then the humanitarian justification for the war is tempered somewhat by the suggestion that we want a dictator who is just slightly less enthusiastic about mowing down tens of thousands of protesters.
Yeah. The humanitarian. No, so again, I'm getting into Marco Rubio's head, not.
Yeah.
But it would be, there's a pretty good track record of transition from authoritarian regimes to functioning democracies. South Korea, Taiwan, and they're pretty good track records of countries that remain non-democratic, but go from more nasty to less nasty, like Vietnam. Vietnam is obviously a better place to live than it was 20 years ago. It's not a democracy at all, but most people are materially better off and have more freedom to live the way, and they don't fool around with your personal life. They're not going to hang you because they don't approve of the way you live.
So you're aiming for a liberal Iran, not necessarily a democratic.
Yeah,
Iran.
You're aiming for a period of transition.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that people who know Iran better than I do remind me is, we are very aware of the highly secular, highly liberal people who live in the big cities. But there is a rural hinterland where people are more conservative. There is some basis of support for the mullah regime. And those people will make themselves heard. And you need to just continue. You need to not base everything on the hope that if you have an election today, the liberals in the cities win. They may not.
G'day, humans. Well, if you've listened to this much of the episode, then you must enjoy it, presumably, unless you're just listening for masochistic reasons. So you should listen to the rest of it. And the way you do that is by subscribing to the premium feed, where you not only get to hear the rest of this delightful conversation, and trust me, oh, it gets better than what you just heard, but you also get to hear no ads, zero ads. And previously, up until now, you had to go to the old Substack to do that and follow me on Substack and add one more platform to your life if you're not already on Substack. But here's the thing. We are now on Apple Premium Podcast as well. So with one click, Apple will just subscribe you up to the premium feed. You'll be able to listen to the rest of this conversation right now, right now, right now. So open up your Apple Podcasts, click the old Pay Old Zepsy button. That's probably what it's called, Pay Old Zepsy. And you click the button and then you no longer have to be a free rider. You can feel like you're contributing to the mission of this show, which is really what we're all here for. Better conversations, a freer, more freewheeling attitude towards the things that we can talk about, a way to steel man our opponents and to take the most gracious approach towards disagreement. That is what you're voting for when you vote for Uncomfortable Conversations by going into your Apple Podcasts and clicking subscribe. I love you. If you don't do that, that's fine. I'll see you the next free episode, I guess. Take care.